Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker with me, Andrew Harrison. Right about now, like all right-thinking people, I should be struggling along public transport with a tent, wellies and plastic bottles full of DIY summer cocktails on my way to Glastonbury. That's not happening this year, and suddenly all those old joke features about how to recreate Glastonbury in your back garden aren't such a joke anymore. The live music industry has been devastated by the pandemic. Venues that have closed may never reopen, and generations of artists who've been told that playing live would replace their lost income from record sales now find that they can't play live either. Meanwhile, the government found no space for a representative from the music business on its Cultural Renewal Task Force, but did have space for the English National Ballet's artistic director and the founder of lastminute.com. Is this an industry killer for a business that, before the pandemic, generated £5.2 billion annually and a further £2.7 billion in export revenue? Here to help me understand all this is James Wright of the United Talent Agency, which looks after some 35 artists, everyone from Underworld to Common to Empire of the Sun. He's been an agent for over 10 years, and his job is strategy. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Nice to speak to you, Andy.
Thanks for joining us. For listeners who perhaps don't know the music industry particularly intimately, can you explain what exactly do you do? What does an agent do?
Well, yeah, as you said, I'm a music agent, and I am really responsible for the live touring careers of the artists that we represent here in the UK and around the world. That can be anything from their own shows in venues to festival performances here in the UK, as I said, and around the world. I think you said at the top of the call, we represent 35 artists. I personally represent between 30 and 35, but as a company, we represent hundreds of artists, you know, in the music space, from, you know, Post Malone to Lauryn Hill, Christina and the Queens, Guns N' Roses. You know, we've got a mass array of artists, or global artists, that work, you know, traditionally known for touring, you know, so that's our space.
So what is the scale of the damage to the live industry that COVID has wrought? I mean, is it possible at this stage to give figures?
Yeah, well, I've been reading over the last couple of weeks a lot into the figures, and as you said, I think at the top that, you know, the UK music industry contributes, you know, 5.2 billion to the economy and sustains, you know, 200,000 jobs. That's what UK music suggests. And then the live sector within that is 1.1 billion of it. Mm. And, you know, we won't see any live business of any merit this year, potentially, you know, and they've sort of suggested the estimates are around 900 million to the economy. That's the damage.
And the Music Venue Trust has just asked to the government for a £50 million injection to stop mass closures in venues across the country. Is that enough? B, do you expect it to happen? C, is this a kind of a sound way to preserve the industry going forward?
Is it enough? Probably not. Is there a real risk of these closures? Absolutely, yes. You know, I think they're citing 90% of venues are at real risk of closure between now and whenever we see ourselves getting out of this. Is it, you know, is it the right thing to do? Is sustainable? I think so, because the Music Venue Trust, for the first time in, I think, 15 years, announced that last year more venues were opening than closing.
Right.
So we were getting it right. The business was getting it right. And so to get through this, you would argue that it's not the business's fault. Therefore, it should be supported to get itself through it.
The going to live music has it's become, it's taken a different place in national life, hasn't it, over the past sort of, you know, 15 to 20 years. Going to gigs used to be something that was perhaps a bit of a specialist interest. Not everybody did it. Now everybody, until the pandemic, everybody does it. And it seems to be, you know, for all that, it's not really seen as being central to, you know, it's not seen as valued by the government. If they can't find space for the live business on a task force to renew the entire cultural life of the country.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly disappointing to see that, you know. And I would argue your point slightly that it's always been a popular sort of entertainment. You know, gigs have always been, you know, been there. You know, stadiums and arenas have always been filled. The mass, you know, commercialization of the arena business, of course, has grown, but the interest from the public has always been there. And as you rightly say, we have no one championing live music in the task force. There is a working group, you know, as you can probably imagine, I've had to become slightly more of an expert over the last couple of weeks in the internal politics of UK government. But there seems to be something called a working group in which sits underneath the task force that does have the Concert Promoters Association, the Arena Association in it, and they are at the coalface of this. But again, you know, to give you some context here, you know, the UK business, music business was 5.2 billion. You know, the UK theatre business, I think I read in The Guardian a week or so ago, contributed 1.3 billion in 2008. So the UK music business is four times that.
Mm. How has this impacted your own business? I mean, what kind of measures did you have to take when it became clear that all these tours that you've planned, not just months, but years ahead, are at best going to be postponed and in some cases just not going to happen?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. There was an element of a rabbit in headlights moment for most of us and a lot of scratching our heads because, you know, we'd had it okay for quite a long time. You know, the live music business, you know, was, you know, got through the 2008 recession without much issue. You know, that sort of dispensing of, you know, money for the pub, cinema tickets, you know, gig tickets seemed to do okay. And then, you know, the demise of the record business and physical product and then the slow uptake of streaming meant that the record business was struggling, but live has always done okay. And then this comes. We all thought it was going to be Brexit that was going to knock us, and no one was predicting this. So, you know, my group, you know, within the touring section, it only works with gigs happening and audiences buying tickets and artists making money. So it turned off like a light switch in March. You know, we're lucky within our particular company, UTA, that we've got a very diverse revenue streams, you know, be it through esports and digital influencers that we also work with. But in general, in the music touring business, you know, we saw it coming from Asia in the early part of the year. We were like, oh dear, that sounds pretty bad, but you know it's not going to come here, is it? And then poor Italy, you know, we all felt sorry for the Italian promoters and like, oh my gosh, you know, can't tour in Italy for a while. And then here comes March, you know, March 15 or whenever it was, and you know, we had bands out on the road that we were seeing that, you know, talking to tour managers every couple of hours going, is there a band in place? Can we do this show? Even if we can do the show, will fans want to be there? Is it right to do the show? Are we letting our fans down by doing the show? Are we legally allowed to do the show? All this stuff over a couple of weeks in March was uncharted territory for a lot of people.
Did you have to take special measures to get people back home from countries where effectively going out had been, you know, had been cancelled?
No, not so much special measures, only the fact that they probably had to, you know, I had one band in particular that was all the way over from Australia and was mid-tour, and I had to make the decision to cancel. In fact, we had to cancel the UK, one of the UK shows before Boris Johnson announced a formal mass gathering ban. So we had to make the very difficult decision based on what, you know, if you remember, there was terminology around advised against, which if you're under a performance contract, isn't kind of covered. And therefore, we have to make these quite difficult decisions to break up tours halfway through during that period. And, you know, there was out-of-pocket expenses, absolutely. They had to fly home early. They had to pay their crew. They had to pay their production because it was mid-tour. So, yeah, there were financial implications.
And presumably, in a lot of cases, you know, it's not going to be the case for every tour. It's not going to be the same. But presumably, insurance will not have covered events like that when you've had to make a judgment call yourself rather than obey an instruction.
Yeah, and even if you're obeying instruction, you know, force majeure is force majeure, and the general consensus that, you know, in most cases, you're not covered for COVID-related cancellations.
Those of us who are music fans know that the entire industry reorientated itself towards live, and often bands that you expected you'd never see tour again are suddenly, you know, quite busy on the circuit, particularly like me. You know, you're a bit older and you love bands from the 80s and the early 90s. They're suddenly very, very active again because it's the only dependable stream. How are bands themselves able to, and artists able to deal with this sudden turning off of projected income? Because obviously they've all got their own support structures. They've got crew, they've got offices to run. You know, have you seen ways that bands have been able to react to this to cope with it?
I mean, I would say that a well-managed band should be able to ride this out, as long as, assuming for this, for the argument's sake, that live touring does come back in some form, or we're all in trouble. But, you know, the bands that you know, the bands that you love and know, if well managed, should be able to get through this, because touring models are based on scaling up and scaling down. So, but it really is the people behind the scenes that will struggle. It will be the people that are freelance engineers, freelance tour managers, people that are, you know, some managers are company directors and therefore can't take advantage of the furloughing scheme because they can't furlough themselves. So these are the kinds of behind the scenes problems that the UK music business needs to find support for.
It is Glastonbury week, as I mentioned at the top. I mean, yeah, it is by some measure the world's most significant festival. What does the loss of Glastonbury and the summer festival season mean for your business?
I know, I was in the car this morning with the kids and Six Music had a bit on Glastonbury, and I realised this year would have been my 15th consecutive one if I'd gone, which is sad. It's immensely important part of any artist's career, the festival scene across the UK and Europe. You know, the fascination that the general public have with the festival, be it here and in Europe and generally globally now, is impossible to measure how important it is to an artist's career at any level. It's a big earner for the established acts. It's a route through to success as a developing act. And to not have that in their diary this year is immensely challenging. It will arguably mean that some bands that were kicking off this year may not get their moment. It will mean that, you know, that some established acts will get put back a couple of years because of it. You know, but again, it's the behind the scenes stuff. It's the not the sexy stuff. It's not the, you know, it's not the Ed Sheerans on the stage, although arguably I wouldn't necessarily use particularly sexy. But you get my point, though. It's the tour managers. It's the security staff. It's the food and beverage businesses. It's the, you know, the people that put up the wall around Glastonbury. They all employed locally. That ecosystem is cut off this year.
Yeah. Well, another ecosystem that's being cut off is that we sort of touched on earlier was the smaller venues leading to the larger ones, and the fact that, you know, an emerging band now will often, you know, follow a path not dissimilar from a band of the 1960s. You will tour, you will play, you will appear a lot, and you will kind of build your audience that way. And that, you know, at best it's been put on pause. But do you think it's going to come back in the same way? Or have we perhaps seen, you know, the peak of live music in its current incarnation?
If we can get support, if these grassroots venues can survive until the business is online again, will be fine. That's the big if. We just don't know. You know, in the FT, you know, I was reading this morning, I think, about the TEG Group in Australia looking to eye up UK venues to buy. TEG Group is a big venue operator and promoter based. It's an Australian-based company, but it's invested. Silver Lake, the investment firm, has invested in them, and they've got a very aggressive business strategy. Now, to me, if Silver Lake are looking to buy UK venues, arguably, you know, my language, not what the FT is, on the cheap, then you would say that surely that's enough of a commercial reason for the government to put their hand in the pocket and get them through this. You know, we were looking, I think we were speaking at the beginning of, mid-March, end of March, I would have said, oh, you know, we're looking at a V-shaped recovery. I think, arguably, we're looking at a fat U at best. And you know, not to stretch it too far, but you know, no one is looking for a W. You know, that's the general reality of it. And my hope is that the government will see a commercial reason now if someone like Silver Lake is looking to buy venues.
So that is, at least in its way, it's a vote of confidence, even if it is.
And I've forwarded that on to the UK Live Music Group this morning and UK Music, because I think that's what we've got to be saying. Look, if you don't want us at the table, you don't want to hear from us, and you'd rather hear about theatres, then at least say that there's a commercial reason to get involved. And as I said, you know, for the first time, the grassroots, you know, music venues are expanding and not decreasing, you know, first time in 15 years. And these people that go into these, operating these venues or owning these venues, aren't doing it for money. You know, this is, you know, I think Music Venue Trust quoted 65% of their revenue is from bar sales. This is a tough business, but it's based on people's love affair with music and arts in general. You know, I think there's been a stigma over the years, which I think, you know, has finally gone, about it being sort of like sticky floors, cheap lager, sweaty young people hanging out, you know, running around causing riots. But the reality is that these are cultural institutions now. These are also, you know, your local cinemas, your folk clubs, your bars, you know, and things like this. So this is how people need to view them and the importance of them.
I've got to say, I would give my eye teeth for sticky floors, cheap lager, and a load of young people running around shouting right now. I'd give my left leg for that after 12 weeks of not.
I average 3 shows a week on normal, and I haven't been to a show in 16 weeks, and I am. It's causing me all kinds of trouble.
Are you climbing the walls? Because I am.
So much. I just want really warm, cheap, well, warm, overpriced lager. That's all I want.
Yeah, any lager of any kind. Touring is also a massively international business. You know, it is all about travel. And you mentioned Brexit earlier. That was already going to put the spokes in the wheels of many, many British artists, and artists particularly use British crew, because it's, you know, it's often the case that tours will start here, won't they? Because, you know, our crews are known to be pretty good. Do you think that, I mean, we've seen countries opening up in a very, very, well, should we say, individual way. Each country opens up differently. Each country will allow people from certain places, not from others. Can you see the touring industry, the international touring industry, being able to navigate this massively more complicated immigration system, when in fact, particularly in Europe, we've been used to just being able to roll over the borders, you know, with a big lorry full of instruments?
Yeah, I think the movement of... there's 2 points. I think the issue around quarantining at the moment and how long that extends for around the COVID situation is an alarming situation that we're going to have to deal with at some point. There needs to be some cohesive plan around that. The movement of people, I'm less worried about, because these are treated as business individuals and therefore probably can be bundled in with the, you know, finance sectors, and no one wants finance people to stop moving and trading, mm-hmm. because the wheels really do come off. My concern is, as you say, around freight and, you know, being held up on borders and you know, things like this and the paperwork required. And I think that stuff is where the industry needs information and clarity and confidence, because the movement of trucks and things like that could be a real issue. Mm.
We mentioned what the government has or has not been doing. Do you think the business itself is doing enough? Because, you know, the popular image out there, not necessarily true, but the popular image is that the music business is a very rich business, and that particularly the recorded music industry is very cash rich. You know, what is the industry doing, you know, off its own bat to deal with this? And is it doing enough, do you think?
Well, first of all, the live music business has no income. It's got zero income. And you know, I think the record business, to some extent, I would agree, could potentially be doing more to support and understand the vital role that live touring plays, you know, for it. But, you know, I think there is... it needs to be an understanding that there isn't a fundamental flaw in our business. It's not as if, you know, the world woke up in the middle of March and went, oh my God, why do we go to live gigs? It's disgusting. You know, it's overpriced. No one has any fun. It's a waste of everyone's time and effort. And you have to get there on public transport because you can't park. No one did that. The business model is sound. It's just this beast came along and no one was expecting it. So I think there needs to be a real understanding that we were doing okay. I would actually argue that the government should be more engaged in music and not rely on how commercially savvy the music business has become, because I think we're cutting off, you know, a younger workforce, you know, a young student population from entering the business because it needs support at that grassroots level. But we were doing okay, and this came along. So I think there is a responsibility here on government to really support us getting through this so that we can just get back to business.
There is one thing we keep hearing about, though, which runs across the hospitality business as well as the entertainment business, fear of going out, FOGO replacing FOMO, the idea that things may open, but people may be, you know, they may have trepidation about taking part. Is that a factor for you guys?
I think it'd be easier for me to dismiss that and say no. Mm. But I think it's probably fair to dig into it a little bit. I think with the older demographic of the sort of 50 plus audience, I can see it having a sort of mirroring effect with the, you know, the sad reality of how this pandemic is affecting, you know, the older population. And therefore, you know, if I was in, you know, my 50s or 60s, and I was not necessarily at high risk, but I'm seeing the same stats as everyone else is, would I be totally comfortable about going to, you know, to an arena, sitting close to someone else that they don't know? So I can understand that argument. I think a younger audience, I don't think this is going to be a problem. Mm. I think they are itching to get back and see things when it's safe to do so. And I think the fear for the older audience can easily be handled with good messaging, good public understanding, and a plan, a simple plan.
I mean, the older audience is massively important. You know, the kind of the mojo reader, the kind of box set buyer, the person who can happily pay 70 quid for a decent ticket somewhere. Does the, you know, because and who sustains the heritage acts that have driven a lot of the live industry. Is that a sector that you think the industry ought to target, that you ought to be kind of, you know, finding ways to make it easier for a 60-year-old music fan to attend more shows?
I think they attend a lot of shows. Mm. You know, I think it's an area that is well covered. You know, I represent, and have represented a lot of acts that attract an older audience. There's certainly a lot of venues that target that demographic, from, you know, the Royal Albert Halls, Royal Festival Halls of the world, through to, you know, the, you know, Symphony Halls in Birmingham and the O2's Arena. You know, I think the audience, that audience has no problem turning out to see the band that they love. My concern is just making sure that we can make it very clear that it's safe to do so.
Just to wrap up, then, we sort of talked at the beginning about the lack of representation on the Cultural Renewal Task Force, the kind of question mark about what government is going to do to help or what it could do. What would you like? Can you give us concrete examples of what you'd like it to do? For instance, there's been talk of cutting VAT on tickets and, you know, possibly kind of taking a different approach to income support for freelance people. What if you were suddenly live music czar and they hauled you in on the Cultural Renewal Task Force and said, here you go, what would you be trying to enact?
Well, once the power had drained from my head, I hadn't just put all my favourite bands onto a gig. It would be, I mean, we need a plan. We need a plan, and I think this is one place where the theatre group and our group is in a similar place. You know, theatre, you know, bars can come on if they allow for bars to open tomorrow. I guarantee that most bars could open by tomorrow or the following day. If they said the same thing to the music business or the theatre business, that's just not possible. Mm. It can take 4 to 6 months to get us up and running, certainly the theatre business. You know, there needs to be a serious discussion and plan around social distancing. And obviously that's a very hot topic right now. It looks like things might change. But it's not necessarily about reducing it. It's about understanding and having a public awareness that our business doesn't work really with any social distancing in place. And that just needs to be understood by government, and there needs to be a constant dialogue about that and how, if it is eventually taken away, what are the conditions in which they may reinstate it. There needs to be a commitment for the furloughing scheme to extend it. And as you rightly said, you know, a lot of this is around about, you know, around young freelance men and women that have either, you know, new to it working independently, new to the, you know, professional working place, that are sound engineers in their local venues, that are now looking down the rest of the year going, what have I done? Oh. They thought the whole of 2019, you know, that this was the career for them, this is the business for them. And we were saying, look, this is the business for you. We employ 200,000 people, come in. And then this happens. So there needs to be an understanding, support, you know, extension of the business loans and the furloughing scheme.
Looking on the bright side, though, when it does come back, it is going to be amazing, isn't it? I mean, people are going to be, it's going to feel like, you know, your opportunity to do something you thought you might not be able to do again. It's going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of people letting loose, shall we say. It's going to be good, and it needs to happen. You know, this country's, you know, cultural backbone is this, and it's been taken away from a lot of people, that even if they don't go to that many shows, I think people like the idea that this is in the ecosystem, this is part of the fabric of our society, and it's incredibly valuable. You know, they, whenever, you've got to think about it, whenever there's a big occasion, you know, a Queen's birthday or Jubilee or something happening, they always roll out the concert, don't they? Yeah. There's always the charity, you know, the, you know, in Hyde Parks, you know, these big moments, they always rely on the artist. You know, it has to be really big.
Yeah, our music, I always tend to think our music is what we have where the United States has Hollywood. You know, this is what, you know, their world is, their cultural centerpiece is the movies, ours is music. And I sort of don't feel like it's valued enough by government, which is happy to put posters up saying music is great and happy to sort of, you know, cite their favorite band in an interview with Radio 4. But when it comes down to it, they just don't really want to support it in the way they'd support other entertainment.
It's true. And I think the point is that the music export is the issue here. You know, we won't be able to export these. We don't have musicians to export anymore because there won't be the infrastructure there for them.
Well, let's hope that something crystallizes in the minds of our government on this one. James Wright, thanks very much for joining us on The Bunker. What gig are you most looking forward to yourself? I've got, I spent a fortune on tickets for New Order and the Pet Shop Boys in New York, and it's been put back a year. So God knows if it's even going to happen. How about yourself? What are you most looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to standing in a field, any field, listening to a band holding a slightly lukewarm cider, looking straight at a band and enjoying the crowd, having a wonderful time. And my hope is I'll be able to do that next summer.
Well, this time next year, I will see you in Worthy Farm and I will buy you that pint. And we can we can look back, hopefully, on how it all got fixed. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been really interesting. Listeners, we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of The Bunker. I'm off to set up a tent in the back garden and hope it rains. We'll see you all next time. Thanks. Bye-bye.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.